Welcome. This is Christopher Holmes, and this is another two-hour show of Zero Point Radio. Thanks to BBS, we're on every second Saturday at 4 to 6 Eastern Time, and I guess 1 to 3 Pacific Time. I have a website at www.zeropoint, spelt out zeropoint.ca. CA stands for Canada, and I'm coming to you from Ottawa, Ontario, Canada, or at least the Ottawa area. And my co-host in the background here, hello, James Moffat.
Hello.
You're in Toronto, Ontario, so this is a Canadian show. How are you, Jim? The rain's passed you by?
No, it was raining earlier today quite a bit, but everything's very, very green, very lush. It's actually quite lovely.
Yeah, it is, too. Everything here is really green and lush. And
after a very long, hard winter, it's really, I think it's really made me appreciate it a little bit more that, you know, we're enjoying this nice weather, and it can rain just as long as it's not snow. It's fine with me.
Yeah. These terrible floods in the Midwest, the United States, eh?
Yeah, what incredible devastation. It just... really remarkable.
Yeah, I'm so sorry for those people. It's hard to imagine, you know, being flooded out and having your land and crops flooded out. It's terrible.
Yeah.
I'm so sorry for American friends.
A lot of damage.
Yeah. Okay. Today I wanted to begin. I live a somewhat unusual lifestyle here at the moment. I'm unemployed or self-employed clinical and forensic psychologist and mystic scientist. And at the moment, I had a five-month period in New Zealand where I got to lecture throughout North and South Island of New Zealand on the teachings of H.P. Blavatsky and the secret doctrine and the physics of the secret doctrine. And then since I've come back and settled into my little cottage by the river here and trying to continue on revising my books once again. And I'm almost through another edition of the Heart Doctrine, Jim. I just went back and decided to go through the whole thing a final time.
Mm-hmm. Good.
Because what I think I may have the help in a little while. I'm going to get my book put into a PDF format, or not a PDF. Yeah, I think it's a PDF format, and then I can submit it to a book publishing place, which kind of prints them on demand.
Oh yeah.
So which would make my books available like through Amazon or any major bookstore.
Yeah.
And they just print them up as orders come in. So I'm going to try that hopefully within the month. And then I'm going to kind of work through my books and try to get two or three of them anyway up, make them available more widely through that means. In the interim, I'm continue to sell my books through my website. If people have a look at my website and have a look under publications, and you can see the six books that I've written. Two of them are on the Gurdjieff Uspensky Fourth Way Teaching. One on the Uspenskian version of the Fourth Way Teaching, and another on the on Gurdjieff's book entitled Beelzebub's Tales to His Grandson. And I've written a book about explaining some of the tales. And then I have a series of books called Within, Without, From Zero Point. And you'll get some idea of that today because we're going to talk about zero points today, and that'll be the basic focus of today's discussion. And then book one of that is called The Heart Doctrine. And the basic thesis of The Heart Doctrine is that human consciousness is not something produced by material neurological processes in the brain, in the head, which the last century of science has tried to convince us that the head brain somehow produces consciousness. But the scientists have never been able to explain how that is done and what part of the brain does it and what the consciousness is and so on. So the issue of human consciousness is like the central enigma in modern psychology and science. And of course it has profound implications for the issues of religion and philosophy. In mystical teachings and spiritual psychologies, the origins of human consciousness are related more closely to the heart. And the origin of the I experience is related to the depths of the human heart. And in my writing, I draw upon that teaching of the heart doctrine, and I explain it in yogic Vedic teachings, Kabbalistic teachings, mystical Christianity, the secret doctrine of H.P. Blavatsky, the Tibetan Buddhism of the Dalai Lama, the teachings of Rumi and the Sufi poets, and so on. We find this heart doctrine throughout what I would call the esoteric literature of humankind. Now, in some places you hear more of what I would call the I doctrine, the idea that your higher self or your higher nature is connected to the awakening of the third eye. And a lot these days people are talking about the Illuminati and their symbol of the eye within the triangle. So that, in a way, refers to the heart doctrine. But in the secret doctrine, or in Blavatsky's work, she says that the I doctrine is a lesser teaching than the heart doctrine, which is a deeper esoteric teaching. So I wouldn't deny that we as human beings can awaken the third eye and attain mystical faculties through that, but I would say that the deeper level of self and that which we want to awaken first is related to the human heart. And once, if we awaken within the heart, then the illumination of that awakening can illuminate higher centers, and we can experience these higher faculties of the spirit soul. Okay, so the Within Without series, book one is entitled The Heart Doctrine, and it explains Western enigmas about consciousness, and then it goes into the spiritual psychology, all about the nature of the heart and how consciousness is said to be connected to the blood flow in the body and the electrodynamics of the heart, and it also explores the idea of us as having zero point centers, again related to the heart. But that's a topic for the second half of our show today. Volume 2 of the Within Without series is called Microcosm Macrocosm. And the idea here is, as above, so below, that the idea is a human being as a microcosm might be created and evolve on the same principles as are made manifest in the origin and evolution of the universe. That the microcosm recapitulates the same dynamics as we find in the creation of the macrocosm, cosmic universe. So book two compares mystical teachings of creation with the newest ideas in modern physics, including material law and creation from singularity points, the nature of the quantum vacuum as void and plenum, which has emerged in modern science, the idea of expanding, contracting space-time complexes, the idea that we exist within a seven-dimensional hyperspace. The newest models of physics postulate a seven-dimensional hyperspace underlying the four-dimensional space-time continuum, which is manifest to our senses. That four-dimensional space-time is an outgrowth or a product of forces which are based in this higher dimensional hyperspace. So that's book two of the Within Without series, and book three of the Within Without series, which I will turn my attention to when I've in time, is called Triune Monads in Seven Dimensional Hyperspace. And what I'm arguing here essentially is that there is a God spark or divine spark within a human being. And this God spark, Blavatsky would call such a monad, or a monadic essence. And this is Blavatsky compares the monad to a spark of fire which is thrown down from this higher dimensional realm of existence. Shirley MacLaine, in her book called Going Within, she said, the basic idea of the New Age is that we all have a God spark within us. Okay, so I'm interested. What is the nature of that God spark? How can we try to understand that concept in the scientific framework? So the monads in hyperspace, I'm saying a human being does have this God spark or higher dimensional element, a monad, that exists within seven-dimensional hyperspace. So triune monads in seven-dimensional hyperspace. And I argue that this little monadic essence in hyperspace has certain spin properties, and its energies and influence are imparted into the ethers surrounding the central point. And that there's a whole higher dimensional physics as to how these God sparks are then clothed in different bodies and come down and exist within different planes of existence. In mystical teachings, Blavatsky says, the number seven is the number of the divine mysteries. And she says, everything in nature, in the physical as well as the metaphysical, is septenary, meaning having a sevenfold nature. Thus, human beings, we are said to have seven chakras. The heart chakra is the central one, but then from the heart chakra, the energies split off or circulate through seven chakras. Okay, so in Blavatsky, everything in creation is sevenfold. There are seven planes of existence. Each of those seven planes is said to have seven subplanes. In Tibetan Buddhism, there are said to be 49 planes of existence. So the idea is we are multidimensional beings having bodies that can exist on different planes of existence. Okay, so that's book three of the Within Without series, and we'll have done most of that actually, but we'll continue to work at editing it and getting it ready. And then I have a book called Zero Point Teachings, which is a collection of different writings from my different books, as well as writings from my website, where I do a lot of reviews, and some of them I think very valuable reviews. I do a shocking critique of the movie called The Secret, which I entitled The Secret to the Cult of Narcissism is my subtitle to that, because in a way I see the narcissistic, materialistic focus of The Secret and how that was popularized. And I do other articles on people like Mark Cummings and new concepts of space-time in physics, and articles on the Dalai Lama. That book, Zero Point Teachings, also contains an assortment of my political writings about 9/11 and letters I've written to CBC complaining about their propaganda and different political pieces I've done. So that's a wide selection of my writings. Okay, so please have a look at my website. All the books are available. And, yeah. Okay, so today we were going to come to discussing the zero points, Jim, but before I do that, we often in our shows, we have some time on mystical spiritual teachings, and then sometimes we discuss kind of the political and world situation. And I live a funny kind of existence in my little cottage working up my writing. And I spend a lot of time on the internet listening to truth broadcasts and different networks and trying to stay abreast of what's happening in the world. As one begins to learn the truth about what is happening, you realize that the mainstream media is completely fraudulent. And really, it presents this, it glosses over all the things really happening around the world. and all the truths which are coming out in this over the internet through networks like BBS Radio and other networks that have some truth broadcasting on them. So I spend quite a bit of time. I listen to Coast to Coast when I can, even though it runs from 1 to 5 o'clock my time. So it kind of throws my day out a little bit too much when I listen to it. But anyway, so I'm going to do a quick rundown for about 15, 20 minutes of some of what I thought were the highlights of stories I've come across and issues and such that I've come across through the last 2 weeks, and then we'll have some discussion of that, and then in the second half of the show, or hopefully more than the last half of the show, I'd like to get back to discussing the zero-point concepts. Okay, Jim, anything you wanted to say or share or comment or before I run through some news items?
No. Actually, just going to say, it's been a while, so I'm trying to think when you were in New Zealand, I guess I was working on Divine Mysteries with you at that point. I think I was reading that, but,
yeah, God, Science, and the Secret Doctrine was the new title.
And before that, of course, I was working on the Heart Doctrine with you and have several times, so it'd be interesting to see where the Heart Doctrine is, because I thought that was probably the closest to being the most complete. I thought there was a lot in God, Science, and the Secret Doctrine, but I thought there were parts of it that you needed to kind of sort of address. Like, I think I remember I told you that in terms of some of the discussions of some of the physics, I thought it was a little bit, interesting, but it was a little too difficult needed to be sort of reworked brought into the context of your discussion a little bit more. But getting back to the Heart Doctrine is that I was just going to say that I like the I think the latest editions of it is probably the best, and it's interesting because one of the things that from earlier versions that I think was partly at my suggestion and partly just how you reworked it, but one of the things that really struck me as odd about it was that you had so much material from so many different sources about how this Heart Doctrine appeared in all these different teachings and in different commentaries by different sages and mystics and masters, that it was almost too much. And in fact, I think it was too much in some sense. But it was really quite shocking, even for somebody like me who is read a fair amount of mystical literature and esoteric literature, I was quite shocked at how thoroughly and consistently this repeated reference to the Heart Doctrine recurs. And at the same time, how that somehow hasn't been translated into discussions of consciousness by modern writers. Like, for instance, if I'm being unfair to this guy, then I apologize, but Ken Wilber is a very prolific writer on consciousness and someone who tries to incorporate not only the mystical and esoteric tradition, but modern psychology and philosophy, and is really an astonishingly eclectic scholar. But I note in his work, and I've read several of his books, I note in his work that I would say to a certain extent that he has a real penchant for creating schemas and diagrams with different levels, which in some ways I think are useful, and in some way I think are kind of miss the point. So he may actually incorporate the Heart Doctrine into his schemas, but I notice that in his writings and just in his commentaries on things, I think he subscribes to the Head Doctrine, and I see it now more and more in a variety of things that I read, how everybody is that's a kind of a tacit assumption that influences almost everybody's thinking when it comes to speaking about consciousness. And yet, the few people who point out that it's an assumption really are addressing, I think, one of the great and most important issues in modern consciousness research. For instance, Stanislav Grof, the psychiatrist and consciousness researcher, says that the idea that the brain produces consciousness is the greatest epistemological assumption of modern thought, and it's the great unrecognized and unchallenged epistemological assumption of modern thought. And that's where I think the Hart Doctrine, if for no other reason, is an extraordinarily important book, because really it provides all of this evidence from the mystical and esoteric tradition in which a very different and consistent theoretical viewpoint is articulated in incredible detail, and is also based on not what just what people are thinking, what people have experienced, which is, you know, it's empirical in the sense that people have studied themselves, and so they've studied their inner world, and you know, you can get into that argument as to whether or not something is empirical if it's externally observable, or if it's, you know, if it's actually the real, the more comprehensive definition of empiricism, I think, is just something that studied consistently can be duplicated by other informed observers, and that's the point of view that Ken Wilber argues in his work. And in that sense, I think the empirical evidence is overwhelming that from the mystical and esoteric tradition, and it's been translated into very elegant, precise, and concise language that consciousness arises in the heart, and it's related to the higher dimensional nature of human beings and the higher dimensional nature of the universe, and that is an entirely different perspective, and I think one that really corrects the errors and the fallacies of about 300 years of thinking in Western science, which has led to consciousness and spirituality and metaphysical realities and everything being withdrawn from the universe and eventually ensconced in the cranial cavities of human beings, so that all of these things are supposedly arising out of the human mind centered in the head. But really, the alternative, a very profound alternative view, is that consciousness is somehow an inherent property of the universe, and it exists and manifests and informs in multidimensional levels in both the universe and in human beings, and that's a strikingly different, radically different conceptualization of what it means to be human, and as to what the nature of the universe is and how we might know the universe. And yet, if you take that working assumption, it can lead to an entirely different understanding of things, which addresses a lot of the most striking anomalies in modern physics and psychology, and some of the most enduring enigmas and mysteries. And it provides, at the very least, a very lucid and comprehensive framework for understanding things that are currently not explicable or understandable if consciousness does indeed arise out of the human brain, you know, located in the head.
Yeah, I see my work in that way as providing like an alternative model of the structure of existence. That in a way that existence is nothing like what it appears to be to our senses. That really it's based upon this higher dimensional physics of the human heart, and that really everything. Life is holographically created, and there's a higher dimensional physics to this, having to do with the reflection and circulation of light out of higher dimensions. And so it really is an alternative model of the structure of existence, because most of the models are all based on kind of, a view of four-dimensional space-time. Most of modern psychology, that there's just the brain and four-dimensional space-time. And we don't conceive that human beings might be multi-dimensional beings, and that there's this whole higher dimensional physics somehow worked out within us.
Yeah.
And it is neat to, as you say, to hear this, to see this teaching in all these different sacred books, and to realize that the Hart Doctrine is this, like, key esoteric teaching, which you find in Islam, you find it in Judaic Kabbalistic teachings, you find it in Christianity, yogic Vedic teachings. So it's an idea that's there, but it's kind of hidden from people. I remember Gurdjieff saying, like, esoteric ideas, they're not secret because they're not there. It's that we can't grasp the significance of ideas. Like, for ideas to be esoteric, we can't grasp esoteric ideas with mundane mind. Like, in a way, they we have to bring ourselves to be able to grasp esoteric ideas, that we're initiated into them in a way through inner experience.
Yeah, and as you say, and they're not hidden. Excuse me, they're not hidden in the sense that, I mean, they are hidden in different ways and on different levels. But the most striking thing that when you begin to understand them and try to work with these ideas, you realize that they're right there. But it's, you know, people, you know, we have ears, but we do not hear. We have eyes, but we do not see. It's like Gurdjieff said at one point that he was asked many times, why are this, is there no reference to sleep in the Gospels to the idea of waking sleep? And he said, it's on almost every page of the Gospels. Awake, you know, sleep not. It's throughout the Gospels. But he said, it just shows that people read the Gospels in sleep like they read everything else in sleep. And
yeah.
So they don't understand what's really staring them in the face. They think that things are meant metaphorically that are literal. And you know, things that are literal are meant metaphorically. So it's really interesting. And I think, you know, remember thinking back like to the very beginning, the first couple of years when we began to study the Gurdjieff work and to get introduced into esoteric ideas about the nature of psychology of consciousness. Remember kind of, I don't know, I think you had the same feeling, but it was like, for me, it was kind of like walking around and like seeing through things for the first time and seeing things and understanding all sorts of things that even like myths and fairy tales and all sorts of things that before I had sort of taken in one way or on one level, all of a sudden I saw them in a completely different way, and everything was sort of speaking to me in a different tongue, and it was an extraordinarily exhilarating and almost like experience, almost like being in a state of grace, in the sense that it, you know, it animated, it inspired me to kind of want to know more and to realize that, geez, I have been asleep all my life. And it's like, you know, suddenly there's this joy.
Yeah, we were continually having kind of experiences of kind of insight and illumination.
Yeah.
And kind of understanding everything in a different way.
Yeah.
I remember I was kind of, I've had different periods in my life which have had that magical quality to it. I think as we penetrate different veils of nature, we can kind of, the magic is there all the time.
Yeah.
And I remember that period of time. I mean, there's some things in the Gurdjieff teaching which are so simple and yet so unbelievably valuable, like the idea that, you know, we have many eyes, how people
yeah.
have many eyes, not just one eye. And then to begin to see yourself from that perspective, all your many eyes, your different moods and personalities, and how they were unconnected, how there was nothing unified in you. You know, and yet then the idea that we could attain real eye, that it's there, we're just not connected to it because of our low state of consciousness. Or other ideas like how human beings are threefold. They function mentally, emotionally, and physically. Something so simple as that. Because I've
yeah.
studied psychology for 15 years in academia, and psychology even today is defined as the science of behavior and the mind, as though there's only a mind, a brain, and the body. It's dualistic. So the whole of modern psychology for the past centuries had no heart or soul. And there's no modern psychology of the heart. No one thinks anymore that you feel feelings in your heart. Not in academic psychology. The poets know it. The
yeah.
musicians know it. People know it intuitively. But science is completely gassed on it. It's
yeah.
like we have had a series of over-intellectualized people thinking about consciousness and then thinking that consciousness was thinking. And they confuse consciousness with their egoic minding processes. So they formulated this completely wrong idea of what consciousness was, confusing it with false ego.
Yeah, I think two things that just to respond to what you just said, I think two things that those very basic ideas in the Gurdjieff teaching is that we, our normal waking state of consciousness should be more properly understood as a state of waking sleep, and that we think that we are conscious, unified beings who do, and that this is these are all illusions. And then his idea that we have multiple eyes, that our eye is always changing, and that we have different groups of eyes that are stronger than others, but that really we have no central unified integrated eye experience. Like, just observing that, I had even actually brought that up as a possible thesis topic at one point, but I didn't know how to operationalize it because I'd observed that myself to a certain extent, but I didn't really have a framework in which to integrate that idea that I was different people in different places in different contexts. And then, like you say, the idea that the triune nature of human being in the normal waking state, that we function intellectually, emotionally, and physically, and that we have these different centers within us which can be thought of as different brains. So we have a brain in the head, and we have a brain centered in the heart and in the nerve plexus of the abdomen, and then we have another brain which is centered in the spinal cord. And this idea that we have these different brains, but they're all acting independently and often at cross purposes and often doing wrong work, leads to a very different understanding of the nature of what it means to be human. And it's like, you used to use this phrase all the time, which I really like. You used to start lectures by asking people, what are the parts of your being? And this is one of the ways of answering it, is that we have a head brain, we have an emotional brain, and we have a physical brain, a moving instinctual brain in Gurdjieff's terms, and then we have a sexual brain. But like, for Gurdjieff's purposes, to describe the normal waking state, he says that, you know, we have an organic brain, which is our sex and our moving and our instinctual centers, an emotional brain, and then this head brain. And he says we don't understand how intimately tied together our moving, our intellectual and our emotional functions are, and how these how they depend upon one another, how they result from one another. So you have a certain thought which starts a certain current of emotion in you, and with that, certain physical postures and movements correspond to it. And, you know, certain movements bring forth certain emotional states which start certain thoughts, you know. And as you observe yourself systematically, you see how true that is. But one of the things that, just the other thing that I wanted to come back to, is this is quite a revelation, because you realize that the whole idea of the whole assumptive basis of modern psychology doesn't really address these very central fundamental issues about how we could be in a state of waking sleep. But the other thing, and this ties into the whole heart doctrine, is that what I found from the Gurdjieff experience is this idea of the multiple eyes existing within us. I don't think anybody in psychology really deals with the question, addresses the question of the nature of the eye experience, and that's where the heart doctrine is so useful, because what it's saying is that we have an eye experience in our normal waking state of consciousness, but that's not the only possible eye experience for human beings to experience and know. So that we have this higher eye within us, but it's dormant, or it's somehow disconnected with our lives and our normal waking state of consciousness. But it's possible to awaken through effort and to begin to experience glimpses of this higher eye experience, and eventually to know this higher eye experience, and to overcome the divisions within us which prevent us from realizing this higher eye experience. And this is something that's completely unacknowledged and completely invisible to modern psychology, but I would say it's like the central question about the nature of psychology. How do we go from being a bunch of little eyes to being AI, one big eye? I mean, in a sense, it's a restatement of the question about how do we attain consciousness and self-realization. But it's the most important thing. It's like psychology wants to treat everything on one level and doesn't really want to recognize the possibility of transformation, of self-transformation. But the esoteric and mystical tradition says the only thing that's important is to realize how to affect self-transformation so that we can realize higher states of consciousness, know our real I. And the real I experience is one which in some way connects us with the universe and connects us with the higher realities of the universe and connects us ultimately with whatever you want to call it, the absolute or the prime mover or God, whatever name you want to give it. It's beyond all names, but it's that there are these higher realities and these higher intelligences that somehow exist within us and we exist within them, but we just don't know it. And that's the real nature of psychology, it's the science of the soul. It's to know ourselves by awakening our higher faculties.
Yeah, to attain to these levels.
Yeah.
I mean, it's interesting. In modern science, no one really thinks that a human being does have an I.
Yeah.
Like, they think in modern cognitive psychology, they think your sense of self is produced by a certain portion of your frontal cortex. So they believe it's only an illusion that there's an I. But that frame, that set of ideas is completely inconsistent with people's intuitive knowledge that the feeling we all have that although our thoughts and feelings change all the time in our life circumstance, there is something that seems to be there that's constant through it all, that's unchanging despite all the contents of consciousness change, but this, the consciousness itself seems to have that constancy. And mystical teachings actually suggest that, yeah, there is that, the presence of self, and we can even attain this through the experience of self-realization, which is exactly, like, it's like the mystical idea, know thyself and thou wilt know the universe and the gods. Well, the self we need to know is not knowing your egoic cognitive self and what you think about things. It's not your usual self that we want to know. The idea is that there is a hidden nature to self, and we have to wake up to attain experiences of this. And that's called self-realization. And then once, if we can experience self-realization, then there are further states of higher consciousness we might attain beyond that. Gurdjieff says that 7 levels of human beings. He says most people are men number 1, 2, or 3, whether they're controlled predominantly by the material, emotional, or intellectual sides of their nature. And we want the first level of awakening or of evolution is in a person who balances and develops mentally, emotionally, and physically, and then attains to the awakening of the self-experience. And that's a man number 4. That's why Gurdjieff's teaching is called a fourth way teaching, is to try to how to get to this level. And then beyond that, Gurdjieff says a man number 5 is someone who's attained the experience of self-consciousness, but that state in them becomes consolidated or crystallized. So they're not just having glimpses of it, but they're established in that state of wakefulness and self-awareness. And then a man number 6 and 7 are people who develop the higher faculties of the mind, and they experience states of what he calls objective consciousness, where he says you can know the truth about existence, about the nature of reality. So we want to attain self-consciousness, and then we can, that opens us up to having experiences of these higher faculties. Yeah, and that perspective is completely lacking in modern psychology. No one thinks that you can evolve in the sense of attaining higher consciousness or developing these higher faculties. Like, that's not imagined in modern psychology. They think everything is just material produced by the brain. When you die, that's it. If it were correct, it would be okay. but the evidence is, I would argue, are absolutely overwhelming that it's not correct.
Yeah.
And I say part of the overwhelming evidence for it is the huge amount of evidence for out-of-body experiences, near-death experiences, mystical states, all these paranormal enigmas, which have been investigated by innumerable scientists. I mean, the evidence for something like ESP, if you take the cumulative literature, I mean, it's billions and trillions to one against the non-existence of these faculties.
Yeah, well,
so
I mean,
really, there's overwhelming evidence, I would argue, for extended concepts of human beings. So then we have to, and most of the concepts which have developed over the years, I would argue, they've been based on an understanding of only 4-dimensional space-time. Whereas I'm saying that what we really need is a more advanced model of higher dimensional physics to understand these bodies and these planes of existence and so on.
Yeah, there's a lot of different things. I mean, I agree with you about the paranormal phenomena and, you know, the considerable body of evidence, incredible body of evidence, both anecdotal and experimental, which really, I think the weight of it is just overwhelming, that it's kind of, as you've often said, it's not whether or not these things exist, it's how to understand them, which is really the more important question, you know.
Yeah.
It really, you have to get beyond that kind of quibbling. The skeptics can naysay and can poo-poo these things and dismiss them, but that's where one interesting thing in terms just that the scientific investigation of these things, it's I think it's in, is it Dean Radin who wrote the Conscious Universe book?
Yeah,
the first book. And one of the things he points out in that book, which is really interesting, is that you often get these arguments from the skeptics that, well, you know, these experiments aren't property control, blah, blah, blah. This could be this, this could be that. Well, really, if you apply those standards to almost everything in psychology, there's very little which would withstand that kind of scrutiny if you applied it equally to everything in psychology, because it's hard to do good experiments in any area of psychology. But putting that question aside for a moment, like what Radin argues is that if you look at the statistical significance of the experimental investigation of paranormal phenomena, what you find is that there are different ways. Like, you can do an individual study and you can establish a confidence level of 0.05 and say that, you know, that it's beyond that, it's a significant experimental result confirming your hypothesis. But what he points out is there's another way of doing the statistical analysis, which is to do an aggregate. I don't actually know what the term is.
Meta-analysis.
Like a meta-analysis of all the experiments done. And what he points out in his book is that when you apply those standards, the odds against finding these results indicating paranormal phenomena are so incredibly vastly complex against this being chance that it's, you know, it's like,
yeah,
it's ridiculous. Like, that was a really interesting presentation and I thought interpretation of the question. And he says, you know, from that point of view, he said the whole skeptical challenge to the experimental investigation of paranormal phenomena really just doesn't stand up, and nobody's ever actually brought that up, you know. And so I was really impressed by that. But then the other side of it all too is that, to me, the more convincing thing is when you read the accounts from people who I think are, you know, demonstrably higher human beings in the sense that they obviously are masters of some sort or had, you know, extraordinary experiences. I think it's really quite overwhelming when you read that the evidence for consciousness existing independently of the body or somehow separately from the body is extraordinarily overwhelming. And so really the question becomes, like, and then the third part of it all is too, is that really when you look at things closely, you can't account for consciousness or life in terms of the materialistic reductionist model, which dominates modern science. Absolutely fantastic for describing certain aspects of things, but not a good model to comprehensively explain things, because it can't. You know, it's just the it just doesn't work. You know, like, ultimately, the limitations of that model are very apparent to anyone who looks at it with an open mind. And that's not me saying that. That's really, you know, most of the major physicists of the 20th century and many of the most astute philosophers of science and many of the most astute biologists will admit you can't account for either consciousness or life in terms of a strictly materialistic reductionist application of that model. So there's all these strikes against explaining things, and there's all this need to explain things that aren't explicable in terms of the materialist model. So that formulates the question, well, how do we explain this thing? And I'd say one of the really, really fantastic and interesting aspects of how you might explain that is the Hart Doctrine, because Hart Doctrine says, look, Royce, there's a major illusion going on here, and until we understand the nature of the illusion, we can't really begin to formulate the questions and formulate the answers correctly. And that's where I see the real value of the Heart Doctrine. And also that in your work, the Heart Doctrine is linked to the idea of zero points and how zero points reflect the idea of the microcosm and the macrocosm and really provide some sort of a causal nexus between the informing of lower dimensions by higher dimensions on both a human and on a cosmic level of scale.
Yeah, it gives you a way of trying to think about what the heart might be, like how could it be higher dimensional, like what would that mean, and how could these processes actually occur. Like, yeah, we need to go further than just saying there's some mystical self. We need to actually try to understand the physics or metaphysics of it, how it could work.
Yeah.
And at least in my work, it, as far as I know, it provides the most advanced model of trying to grasp the, at least address these issues, not necessarily implying that what I'm arguing is right, but at least it provides a framework of ideas deserving of serious scientific philosophical question, like examination. You know, it is an alternate model of consciousness. Like, the scientists all agree no one can explain consciousness. Okay, so leave it out. The door is open then to consider an alternative interpretation and understanding.
Yeah, and really, belabor this point, because we've certainly gone over this on previous programs, so forgive me if for those who have been listening before, if I sort of, you know, continually beat this point over the head, but it's, well, that's where I want to beat it, is over the head, but it's amazing how, like, the whole 20th century of the study of consciousness, really, there's been such little progress in terms, we have all these fantastic machines and equipment now that we can, you know, investigate all sorts of processes in the brain and have this, have PET scans and CT scans and MRIs and all this stuff. And, you know, very interesting findings coming out in neuroscience about various aspects of the working of the brain. But that shouldn't be confused with explaining consciousness. And again, I'll go back to the introduction of the Gurdjieff work, and what struck me is that the idea of self-remembering is that we don't remember ourselves in our normal waking state, that it's possible to work at remembering ourselves, and by remembering ourselves we can change the quality of our consciousness. Well, after doing that for a year, I began to realize that this to me was the most important psychological experiment you can do for a couple of reasons. One, because it's very hard to remember yourself, which just indicates to me how asleep we normally are. And two, the quality and the change of the experience of one's consciousness is so dramatic that it's really so compelling and inspiring. It's really, you realize this has to be the key to understanding something completely different about the nature of ourselves and about the nature of the universe. And then when it's buttressed by an elegant formulation like in the Gurdjieff psychology, then you begin to understand, oh, okay, well, this is a completely different formulation of things, but this is based on a completely different understanding about what it means to know consciousness, that we don't study consciousness by studying it in others or by studying it in laboratory rats or undergraduates. We know consciousness by studying it in ourselves and working to develop it within ourselves, because then you begin to see, you begin to understand and appreciate it subtly, but you also begin to understand the formidable nature of the obstacles which render it invisible to us, in which the illusions in which it consciousness is shrouded, and when you begin to penetrate those illusions, you begin to understand, this is what the mystics are talking about, this is what these extraordinary experiences are based on, this is just a peek through the keyhole, but it's such an illuminating peek that you realize, there's a whole other world there that's completely invisible to us.
You realize you're on a path, kind of, like a path of awakening, that it's not something that happens just at once. Or even if you have moments of awakening, you kind of fall down again and lose it.
Yeah,
it's a lifelong process.
And that's the amazing thing, is you can have all these incredible insights into things and go right back to sleep immediately. You know? And I remember, you know, like with us, remember, like, both of us kind of had constant reminders of this, but when I used to come and visit you all the time, and I would try to get out of your car all the time, and I'd keep forgetting to undo my seatbelt, you know, and it was kind of like happened over and over again. It's just kind of like this little, you know, this little reminder of, like, oh boy,
how asleep you are.
You know?
Yeah, you used to have a good term. I liked it. The cosmic banana peel,
well,
you used to call it, eh?
Yeah, well, that's my, every time I began to feel some sort of sense of pride about the extent to which I had awakened or some sort of insight I'd gained into something would happen immediately afterwards, which was so unequivocally and dramatically an indication of the extent to which I was asleep. I termed it as it was like the cosmic banana peels. Like, as soon as I started taking any pride in what I had quote unquote achieved, you know, I'd step on this banana peel, and there I would be lying on the floor, you know, with all my illusions shattered.
False ego.
About awakening, you know, and it's like, yeah. But, and that was the other side of it. It was almost kind of like there was this sense of being in communication with something higher, which was kind of taking fun of me, you know, like that's what I found. It was like there was this kind of constant humor to things in a way, like, you know, without making it sound too goofy, it just seemed like that there were messages that, you know, there's a lovely phrase that Maurice Nickel, student of Gurdjieff and Uspensky's, used. He said that that there are constantly voices talking to us from above, but we fail to hear them in our normal waking state. But when we awaken our emotional center, you know, as we open our hearts, we begin to hear these voices. And I think that as much as people of a skeptical nature would roll their eyes at that, I think that's a psychological fact, and I think that's a very important psychological fact that anyone who really tries to work on themselves and to awaken discovers, is that there are voices speaking to us from above all the time, and we do not hear them. But it's possible to begin hearing them, or at least, you know, begin to detect their presence, which it's hard to describe that if you haven't sort of had the experience of it, and if you haven't had the ongoing experience of it. But I think it's, as I say, I would say that that's a psychological fact. You won't find it in any psychological textbook, but I think it is a psychological fact.
And then all the amazing things that happen when you're in a state of heightened wakefulness, like all the coincidental things.
Yeah.
The meaningful things that happen all the time, with synchronous events, you weren't awakened to it, you wouldn't even realize, in a way, the interrelationship between different things that happen. But if you're awakened, it's like it kind of opens up this magical world of how we're so interconnected to the things that happen to us and the events around us and so on.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, I mean, in a way, one of the things is that I think that studying yourself and becoming involved with an esoteric teaching and trying to study yourself systematically and trying to awaken and know yourself, it provides a perspective. And all of a sudden, life in general, you get more of a distance. You step back from it somehow. You disidentify with it. That's part of it. You disidentify with it emotionally, but also you get a perspective. And it's like the comparison I made, it's like your life is composed of these tesserae, which are that's the name for the tiles in a mosaic, and you see you begin to see patterns in things that you never saw before, because you were too involved, you were too immersed in the rule of sleep, and you were too involved in your own identifications. But as you start to free yourself a little bit, things that were always there begin to emerge for you, and you begin to understand the pattern of things and begin to understand how things that you never thought were connected are indeed connected, which is really...
Yeah, it's a nice... The way you describe it is nice. It's like normally you just take one piece after another sequentially.
Yeah.
And you kind of... Whereas if you kind of rise above yourself and you see the whole patterns of the pieces. and the kind of meaningfulness of things, you have to have that higher perspective in order to grasp the meaning of the pieces.
And
whereas if you just go along, it's this piece and this piece and this piece,
yeah,
and everything is sequential, then none of those pieces have any broader significance.
And
yeah, it's amazing experience, like awakening and having experiences of it, awakening and insight and realization. And it's not just something you kind of happens once and you're there and that's
yeah.
it. It's not like that at all. It just kind of, you know, you have experiences of awakening and illumination, and that, then it can take you months or years to assimilate that and then have more experiences. And I see that pathway to self-realization as kind of a lifelong pursuit. And I mean, we've both kind of pursued that now for 25 years, and I feel I'm learning every week still.
Yeah, and I like what, you know, when you said earlier, you're talking about it being a, you know, a journey, and it's like that great statement from Lao Tzu that the journey of 1,000 miles begins with one step, you know, and that's it. You take these steps, you know, and there's a bigger goal involved, but you have to, you know, it comes in pieces, and often, I mean, I think that's what's really amazing is that when you revisit things, that you learn more, you gain like a much deeper apprehension of what you've experienced, and you're able to connect more things. I mean, ideally, that's what you would do. But something that you were saying about kind of twigged with what something you had mentioned earlier. I think that in the lives of the masters and teachers throughout history who have appeared. And you read some of these phenomenal accounts of their powers and their capacity to demonstrate like a way of knowing which is beyond that which most people understand or even can even imagine. I think like it's like what I was describing is that just by waking up a little bit, you begin to see things. Well, imagine for somebody who's worked and who has actually developed some sense of unity and who's developed some sort of a connection with a higher being body so that they can exist in their astral body. I think that starts to begin to address your question about, or begins to address your what you talked about how modern thought is locked into this kind of trying to understand everything in terms of four dimensions. You know, well, I think these people apprehend these higher dimensions and that they're operative in these higher dimensions. So we can't even begin really to imagine the kind of connections they can make, the kind of things that they can know, the kind of things that they can understand, and you know, it's like what would appear to be miraculous to us is just the manifestation of something that someone who exists in a higher dimension understands, you know.
I've experienced that at times in states of illumination where I can have whole new insights into whole periods and things that happen through my life. It's like all these patterns become revealed to you. Yeah, it happens at times. I've also had experiences of times of being awakened in my mind's eye, of being able to put my attention into anything, and it's like that knowledge or something is revealed to me, and it's an amazing. It's like you can cast your mind anywhere, and that's revealed to you. It's amazing. Some of the it's hard to maintain those high level states, but amazing some of the experiences that can occur. Okay, well, I did want to come to zero points, but I did want to do my, I have just a page of notes here from things that have stood out to me in the last 2 weeks of my internet listening, and
you
I'm going to just kind of go through these items quickly, and then, put aside the political aspect and come back, and why don't we spend most of the last hour, we'll come back to discussing the zero point concept.
You asked me a half an hour ago if I had anything to say, and I said no.
we always find stuff to say. It's
yeah.
amazing how we fill in and it comes so easily.
So
yeah, we used to just carry on conversations like this. Now we get to do it on air and have a record of it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's great fun, and certainly appreciate having a forum on BBS and on the internet and being able to speak to people all over the world. It's you know, it's a real treat, and
yeah,
people enjoy it as much as we do.
Especially, yeah, I feel, I mean, you know, my own feeling is that we're in these very, very serious times. I'm thinking that between now, 2008 and 2012, like, we are bordering on moving into a kind of fascist new world order, or we're going to have a new age of awakening and solving the problems of the world. So I see us as that, kind of at that kind of critical point. And so I think this kind of teaching is particularly pertinent to us at this time in human history. It reminds me of Gurdjieff's, one of the teachings at the end of Beelzebub's Tales to His Grandson. He says to his grandson, he says that only one thing can save humankind, and that is if they had implanted in them an organ which reminded them all the time of the inevitability of their own death. And it's like if we were reminded of the inevitability of our own death, it would provide like such a shock that you'd kind of wake up and be so conscious of what you were doing and your time and so on. And I feel we're in that type of time, that the type of times upon us remind us of the inevitability of our own death. Like, I see Americans, Canadians, people around the world at this time, we're in serious, serious trouble with all the things that are going on internationally and the pollution of our environment, all these terrible things happening in the world. I think humankind is at a tipping point. And so we've got to wake up. You know, if we don't wake up, horrendous things are going to come down upon us. So especially it's a critical time. Just like it was a critical time when Gurdjieff met Uspensky just before the war, and they had to escape and traveled across Europe. And Gurdjieff said, you know, at a time like this of chaos and man's inhumanity to man, it's an especially important time to work on yourself because of the seriousness of the times. And I feel we're in such times at this period. Okay, so I'm going to just take, I had a few notes. I won't go into details of these, but I do get to do a lot of internet research and some of the things that stood out to me. One was the floods, Midwest floods in the United States, how, again, it raises these questions. What is being done with weather modification, and what is being done with the HAARP programs? And is this something intentional, because it seems one of the new weapons of the New World Order people is wanting to bring about mass starvation. And this is going to be very significant dents in the American food supply and the world food supply. So I think this, again, like, is this possibly a consequence of weather modification? And alternatively, if it's not, why is the government not using their methods of weather modification to lessen such floods? Because we know now, it's come out, that not only the Americans, but the Chinese and Russians, they've been working at weather modification for a significant period of time. And again, it's an area where the government just won't let the people know what is or is not being done. So much in our governments is held secret, and people are so deceived. Okay, that's the first item, just about the flooding, and send our prayers out to the people in the Midwest, the United States, that they rally that great American spirit and get through this. Second thing, some interesting material on oils. I saw an interview, I forget the fellow's name, a chaplain who worked with a big oil company up in Alaska, saying that this idea of there being an oil shortage is complete fraud, and that there are these absolutely massive oil supplies off Alaska. He says enough to provide oil to the United States for 100 years, but they've intentionally turned off these and are not using this oil. And it's amazing, you look at it, how much the American government has restricted Americans from drilling their own oil all through the Midwest and on the coast and so on. It's like this is intentionally... It's like there's so much oil there the whole time, but the government's intentionally brought about this kind of fearfulness that there's not enough oil. Okay, and it's interesting that new theories about oil, like I always thought, or I never believed it actually, was told since being for 20 years or something that oil is due to the decay of organic tropical forests and all these organic materials break down and form oil deposits. But when you really think about it, how realistic is that? You think of the huge oil reserves all around the world. You mean there were such huge organic forests everywhere that they degenerated and made such massive oil deposits all around the world? And I think, no, the newest theories coming out of Russia, I think it's called amniotic theory, is that oil is something produced by the earth and replenishes. It's not simply something of which there's a fixed supply. But that's very interesting questions around oil. And another thing related to oil is, seeing this week in Japan, it was revealed they have a little car that runs on water, completely on water, and they're going to start manufacturing these in Japan. And you think, well, if our governments were, you know, you got so many unemployed people and you're shutting down all the auto workers' plants and that, if the government really cared for the people, the government would just undertake a project to start manufacturing cars that run on water. You know, it would be so simple if there was any responsible politicians anywhere to really invest in this. You know, they talk about new energies and renewable resources, but when you have these discoveries that come out, you know, then the huge effort to suppress those discoveries. You see, it's like that the elites want people to be impoverished. They want to bring in their carbon taxes and create this kind of fear about the depletion of the oil reserve and so on. Okay, another issue next, Iran. We're continuing to have this great risk to the world that the U.S. and or Israel are going to attack Iran and commit another international terrorist act. Because it's funny, you know, who's called the terrorist depends on who owns the media, really. You know, it's like the Americans and Israelis might bomb Iran because of the threat of terror from Iran, but then we commit terrorist acts to kill, murder the murderers, you know. But in a way, it's such a fraud. We've become the terrorists. You know, people talk about Iran threatening Israel. Meanwhile, Israel is blatantly saying they're about to bomb Iran. Like, you know, we are the terrorists. You know, people have been so deceived as to who the terrorists were. You know, we thought the Americans went around the world saving the world from terrorism. Well, really, they've gone around the world spreading terrorism themselves. They are the terrorists. They've become so. CIA is the world's leading terrorist organization. Involved in the assassination of Robert Kennedy, John Kennedy, Lennon, all these people, all staged events and Oklahoma City bombings, all these things we thought were outside terrorists really have been perpetrated by terrorists within our own society, within the CIA and this criminal elite. Anyway, so we're still, hopefully, you pray that this doesn't happen, and it's funny because they present this as though, well, if you care for Israel, Israel's got to have the right to kind of bomb Iran before Iran acquires nuclear weapons. But really, I think that there's a huge danger here for the people of Israel themselves. I don't think a war against Iran is anything for the people of Israel. If you cared for the people of Israel, the last thing you would want is for them to attack Iran, which could set off widespread devastations and wars and rebellions throughout the Middle East. That's not for the people of Israel. It's so insane to think that. I came across one place this week that said that Iran had 80 to 100,000 missiles. Okay, so, I mean, if a war is instigated, Iran has a right to fight back, of course, you know. Now, I think the Americans or the elites, in a way, they know that they start a war over there, the Iranians will down their fleet within the Gulf there. I think those people are sitting ducks. And I don't think the elites really care because they'll get the contacts to rebuild the Navy. But, I mean, the American soldiers and sailors over there may care and their families may care. I think that this risk of this attack against Iran is just a terrible, terrible thing. It was nice to hear Ron Paul speak out against it. I heard one clip on the internet over that. Okay, another item. Last night, watched some of the Clinton Chronicles. My goodness, what a family, what a case he is. If you haven't watched the Clinton Chronicles, a very interesting background to the former president of the United States. Canadian House of Parliament this week on Monday, they read a petition which had been filed with the Canadian House of Parliament called requesting an investigation of the events of 9/11. Now here, people around the world are realizing 9/11 was an inside job and it had nothing to do with Osama bin Laden and his reindeers. Like, people have to grow up and overcome their childhood fantasies. You know, we've been lied to by the governments. And there's an agenda here. And this truth needs to come out. And in the Canadian House of Parliament, the investigation of this was taken up by Stockwell Day, which which doesn't bode too well for any serious investigation of it. I mean, the governments know the truth of 9/11 now. I mean, they're simply complicit in hiding it from the population. This is known by the governments and the intelligence agencies. Okay, another interesting little clip I was sent. This is the Masonic Lodge in Toronto. Is tomorrow afternoon, is offering free implants for any children in Toronto. You want to have your child be chipped? Well, then they're going to be offered freely by the Masonic Lodge in Toronto tomorrow. So all you people in Toronto, you want to get your kids chipped, send them right over there, get the mark of the beast. Yeah, absolutely insane. And anyway, how many kids are disappearing? And then if they're disappearing, who are the ones they're likely disappearing to? It's the elites once again. So this is an absolutely crazy thing being offered in Toronto. They're bringing these chips in gradually. In New Zealand, when I was there, all animals had to have chips in them. And then you have Alzheimer's patients. Then you have kids. See, all these things are brought in incrementally. So people are brainwashed enough through the TV that they line up to get these things. They're inoculations, their newest inoculation. I hope all you Canadian men are going out and getting your Gardasil vaccinations. In Canada, they're actually promoting them for men now. So go get your poisons. Yeah. Okay, that was Masonic Lodge of Toronto. Well, way to go, Masonic Lodge. Alex Jones had an interesting guest this week, two scientists from the group that's Architects and Engineers Investigating 9/11, amazing new discoveries about some of the nanoparticle materials, which apparently the floors which took the impact from the airplanes had, prior to 9/11, were floors coated with this new anti-fire resistant materials, which they now suspect was this nanoparticle thermite or some explosive substance which can actually be sprayed and has explosive qualities. So there's a kind of new evidence coming out about this. Very interesting. And what else here? Oh, interesting article coming out. Marijuana is supposed to have cancer-fighting properties. There's some evidence for that emerging. I heard a horrendous piece on one show about these plans of China and the plans for Chinese troops to invade America. That's hard to know the truth of that, and that might be part of their agenda, that the America be flooded with foreign troops. And what else? Who will end up in... Oh, yeah, my question is, who will end up in the camps, the FEMA camps of America? Sometimes I think it's good to imagine, like in the concern about the New World Order, the advance, sometimes I think people, we need to grasp what could be in the world if we could ever regain control of the criminal elites who run our government and countries. Like, what could come about if we could actually ever deal with these people? I mean, the evidence is now overwhelming of the criminal activities of these elite families and these politicians. All through the states, BBS this last week had an interview with this fellow from California, Bugliosi, Jim, do you know the name, who has written this book, The Prosecution of George Bush for Murder?
Yeah, Vincent Bugliosi.
Bugliosi, yeah.
Bugliosi. He used to be the Assistant District Attorney of Los Angeles. He was the guy who supposedly came up with the Helter Skelter thesis about...
and he laid the groundwork for people so that any district attorneys in different states around the United States might be able to bring murder charges against the president and his bum buddies there. And that this could be done throughout the states. And there are now, I've heard on other radio shows, there are different groups who are moving forward with this. So that's a hopeful element. Okay, so I wonder, who will end up in all those FEMA camps? Okay, so, what could end up is the people will be in those camps, and some people are predicting mass exterminations of Americans, and I believe also that we're very at risk in this. And I imagine, wouldn't it be neat if all those FEMA camps, you could have the real criminals in those camps and then treat them humanely and bring them to justice over time. And then the camps could end up serving a very useful purpose if Americans could ever take your country back. Okay, and then I watched interesting YouTube videos on the moon landings, just more evidence, someone taking apart the photographs of the moon and showing more and more, like, it's absolutely overwhelmingly convincing to me now that most, if not all, the shots of the moon were shot in studios. And apparently there is a model of the moon, of a certain portion of the moon, a model which is 2 miles long and wide and is supposed to be somewhere in the Midwest of the United States, which is the model which they were supposedly used. They had different models. And in this video, it showed the models they had of the moon and of the landscape of the moon and so on. And that this whole thing was done using models. So this was another of the great hoaxes been fostered on, brought down on the American public by our media and by the elite.
I interject and say I think that's a complete load of crap.
Have you ever watched any of them, Jim? The analysis?
No, but I still think it's a complete load of crap. I don't believe it. I'm sorry.
Think that they actually got to the moon?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I do. Yeah. Many times. I just think what's the point of faking it? That would be my question.
Because they'd received billions and billions of dollars, and because Kennedy had kind of posed this challenge to the American people, types of reasons.
And the Russians were trying to get there too. I mean, there was a space race. There were people in space. I find it absurd.
Ever watched any of the exposés on it?
No.
To me, one of the most important exposés, you look at shots of the lunar module on the moon, okay? Mm-hmm. Now, if those modules descended on the moon, they would have had retrograde rockets which were firing to slow their descent, okay? That would create major crater under the lunar module, and as it descended, it would have created dust clouds, which would have created all these clouds which then would have settled on the lunar module. But you look at the pictures of the lunar module on the moon, there are no craters, and they're all nice and clean and all ready for it to be photographed. If you look at some of the evidences, I'll send you a few clips to have a look at.
I guess that raises the question. It's like, if these guys went out to all that trouble to fake it, why wouldn't they do a better job of faking it? I mean, you know.
Well, they did pretty well. I mean, I think the truth about it only started coming out. I don't really know. It was about 5 years ago I began to question.
But people have been claiming that for 40 years about, you know, they faked the spacewalk, they faked this, they faked
that.
Oh, yeah. I mean, even when the first spacewalk occurred, they said, oh, they faked it, you know, like it was, yeah. But, you know, I want to raise something, though, because you mentioned Bugliosi. Bugliosi, I was quite surprised that I saw that he was on BBS, and unfortunately I wanted to listen to the program, but he's also written this massive book on the Kennedy assassination called Reclaiming History, which is a complete and utter pile of garbage. I haven't read it. I'm not going to read it. And I don't need to read it because, his claim is that Lee Harvey Oswald acted alone.
It's shocking, eh?
I started to read the reviews of it. And there was a brief excerpt in Time magazine between him and David Talbot, who's written a book called Brothers, The Hidden History of the Kennedy Years, which is what I actually want to talk about. And as one of the veteran Kennedy assassination researchers says, quite shocking that Time magazine would actually even print this exchange, because Time Life was one of the major sources to pushing the veracity of the Warren Commission and upholding it. Of course, Time Life bought the original copy of the Zapruder film and secreted it away and wouldn't show it to anybody. Eh?
Oh.
So anyway. So Bugliosi has written this book and claims to have, you know, put 20 years of research into it. And so I'm just reading this brief little excerpt, and he starts talking about these things, and everything he said is completely wrong about, you know, I'm just like, I mean, it's just completely nonsense, you know. He's like, you know, and the descriptions I read of the reviews of it, he said he keeps calling people who are conspiracy theorists, quote unquote, kooks, and that they're liars, that they're misrepresenting things to people, and they're trying to deceive them for profit and everything. So, at the same time, I just read this book by David Talbot. David Talbot was a journalist with Mother Jones magazine, kind of radical political magazine in the United States, and was the online editor of Salon.com when Salon.com started on the internet, one of the more interesting political sites. So anyway, so I read this book. And it's about John and Robert Kennedy, and one of the essential questions that he answers, that he addresses, is that, and this has always been brought up by people who don't believe there was a conspiracy as well, okay, why didn't Bobby Kennedy, who was Attorney General when his brother was murdered, do anything to investigate it? Why did he keep maintaining that he believed the Warren Commission? And this has always been, it's been cause for speculation as well, because the Kennedys were trying to murder Castro, and he thought that if the assassination was probed more deeply, it would find out that Castro had killed Kennedy, or that they would find out that he and his brother were trying to kill Castro, blah, blah, blah. There's even a book called Ultimate Sacrifice, which makes his thesis that it backfired and blah, blah, blah. Anyway, Talbot's book is really good because he interviewed about 150 people, all of the people who remained from the Kennedy administration, many of the people who were key players at that time. And first thing he points out is that the day that it happened, Robert Kennedy immediately thought there was a conspiracy to murder his brother and phoned anti-Castro Cubans and said, did your guys do it? And then phoned the CIA and said, did you guys do it? And what Talbot points out is that essentially Bobby Kennedy never believed the Warren report, even though he maintained in public that he did, and that his whole goal was he was going to try to get elected president in 72 because he figured that Johnson would be reelected in 68. He didn't count on the development of the Vietnam War going as it did, and then he would be reelected in 68, and then he would challenge in 72. But then McCarthy beat Johnson in New Hampshire, and Johnson pulled out of the race, and then so Kennedy entered it. And the tacit thesis of the book is that he was murdered in California after winning the primary because it looked like he was going to become president. He was going to reopen the investigation. He had never kind of put it aside. And the book makes it's a good book. It's in some ways flawed, but it makes a very strong case. And the thing that really struck me in watching the movie 13 Days, which is based on Bobby Kennedy's book about the Cuban Missile Crisis, is how much the military not only didn't like John Kennedy. They were insubordinate to him. I mean, they wanted to go to war with Cuba, and they thought he was weak, and they thought he was wrong. And we would, you want to talk about humanity being on the brink. In 1962, the world was on the brink of being destroyed by a nuclear war because these clowns in the Pentagon wanted to start World War III. And General LeMay, head of the Air Force, said, Kennedy said to him, what will the Soviets do if we attack Cuba? And LeMay said nothing, and Kennedy looked at him like, this guy's insane, you know? And LeMay ended up being George Wallace's running mate in 1968, which just gives you an indication of his politics. But the whole Joint Chiefs of Staff, they wanted a war. The CIA wanted a war. The CIA hated Kennedy because of the Bay of Pigs and because he wouldn't provide air cover for them after the invasion failed. But Kennedy felt that he was being set up that the invasion was supposed to fail, so that then when they called for airstrikes, he'd order airstrikes, which would have started de facto war with Cuba. And then he'd have no choice but to commit ground troops, and they'd have to invade Cuba, which is what the CIA and the military wanted. So
isn't Kennedy, John Kennedy, he also made that comment, he wanted to smash the CIA.
Well, that was after the Bay of Pigs. He said he wanted to splinter it into 1,000 pieces, and that was part of his program, as he wanted. Well, he fired Alan Dulles and Richard Bissell, who was Alan Dulles was the head of the CIA. Richard Bissell was the head of plans of operation, or whatever it's called, a major player. Yeah. And then, of course, Alan Dulles labored mightily and got himself on the Warren Commission to investigate the murder of John Kennedy. And really, the tacit argument, he doesn't completely come out and say it, but he makes a pretty convincing case in this book that the CIA murdered John Kennedy. And, very strong case, actually, that they did it. And elements of the military and the anti-Castro Cubans, the mob, they may all have been involved, but it's looking more and more, and there are more and more books coming out now that really, it's funny, like all the negative reaction to Oliver Stone's movie, but Oliver Stone's thesis that Kennedy was the victim of a coup because he was going to withdraw from Vietnam, and because the military hated him, and they thought he was a weak president. And he was trying to pursue some sort of detente with the Russians, too. He was murdered for that. And the more I read, the more the material that comes out, the more that appears to have been the case. And as you say, if you think we live in perilous times now, we lived in pretty perilous times in 1962. We were that close to a nuclear war, close. And if it hadn't been for Bobby Kennedy and Robert McNamara, of all people, there probably would have been a nuclear war. It's a Hollywood movie, and it's not entirely historically accurate, but you should see that movie 13 Days. It's pretty interesting.
I'll watch that because
it's based on, as I say, it's based on Bobby Kennedy's memoir about what had happened, because he was placed in charge of a group of military and state people to try to decide what they were going to do about this, because they really didn't know what the Russians were doing with the missiles in Cuba. Like, was it the preparation to start World War III? I mean, there was a legitimate fear that the Russians were going to attack them. Eh? Yeah. So it's really interesting to see but what the movie really portrays is the insubordination of the military to it, and, you know, the lack of respect towards Kennedy. That's what got me sort of thinking again and again about this. It's interesting, too, because David Talbot, this guy, I read a review of his book by Jim DiEugenio, who's a major, really informed and interesting assassination researcher, had a magazine for many years, and he reviews the book, and he says that he points out that when Stone's movie came out, Talbot was amongst those who poo-pooed the idea that Kennedy was going to withdraw from Vietnam, and that this was the reason that he was killed. But that had just started to come out. There was a book written by John Newman about Kennedy's plans to withdraw from Vietnam, and then there was a dramatic reversal within days afterwards, that there was a conference in Honolulu, and Johnson recommitted the United States to war in Vietnam, and that was the change. And at the time, a lot of people said, it's a complete load of BS. I thought it was, you know.
Oh, yeah.
But then, as more and more information has become declassified and become apparent, you realize, well, that's exactly what happened. And to a certain extent, I have to say I'm pretty pleased in reading this book because, you know, I admired John Kennedy when I was younger, and I especially admired Bobby Kennedy because I think he had the courage of his convictions to actually change his mind about things, and I think he became a better person towards the end of his life than he was earlier. But, you know, there's all these books about what a bunch of scumbags they were and how immoral they were, and there's been a lot of disinformation, I think, published about them, and that they, you know, they were just these thugs and these creeps and everything. But really, I think that John Kennedy really was trying to chart a new course. After the Bay of Pigs, he said that the Joint Chiefs of Staff were just a bunch of old men. That's how he described them, a bunch of old men. Yeah, he just thought they were a bunch of jerks, you know, basically. And the feeling was mutual. They despised them, and to the point where, as I say, they were insubordinate and should have been taken out and shot, you know, like for some of the things they said about them. But and then you realize, too, that one of the things, this whole thing about talking about the assassination, whether or not Lee Harvey Oswald did it or not, is like it completely deflects attention from the terrible political atmosphere that existed and the reasons. You have to put Kennedy's assassination in context. It's what we were talking about earlier about, you know, getting a perspective on things. Well, if you stop, it's like your claim that, you know, rather than trying to figure out whether or not paranormal phenomena are real, let's just assume they are and start to try to understand, you know, how we can explain.
Yeah, work it out from that.
Well, and then, and that's Mark Lane, who wrote the first great book about Rush to Judgment, about the Kennedy assassination and the Warren Commission, and pointed out all the flaws in it. And I just started rereading it, you know. The introductions by Hugh Trevor Roper, within the first five chapters, the Warren Commission, Lee Harvey Oswald would never have come to trial because there wasn't any evidence against him. I mean, my dog could have gotten this guy off, like in terms of a court case, you know, reasonable doubt. But as he says, he's talking about Bugliosi's book. This is an article he wrote about Bugliosi's book, and he says, when he's asked to speak at conferences about the assassination of JFK or comment upon a new scientific finding, again refuting the coincidence theory of history, I have respectfully declined with these words: "It is round, for the world is not flat, and further proof of that theory is not required by most of us, and have little of interest to almost none of us." Exactly, like, you know, instead of like trying to prove whether or not Lee Harvey Oswald, he didn't do it. You know, let's just do away with that silly notion to say, well, Osama bin Laden and his reindeer.
Didn't bring down the towers.
Let's try to explain what actually happened instead of looking at the patsy and realize that there's this continuing source of disinformation about all these things that is produced in the media by the CIA, by the American military, by these people to keep you from understanding what's going on. People like Bugliosi, you call these people kooks and question their psychological sanity, and that term conspiracy theorist is so stupid. I mean, it doesn't mean anything. It means that you believe more than one person did something. Well, the evidence is not only there, it's overwhelming that more than one person did something, and it's overwhelming that Lee Harvey Oswald wasn't one of the two people doing something. But here's the thing is that what do you call all of the people in the American government over the last 45 years, and all the people in the American media who have been in positions of power to question these things, to open these things up to real investigation, and have done nothing?
Complicit. I mean, they've all committed treason.
Legally, they're accessories after the
fact. Yeah, they are.
They're morally, they're bankrupt and immoral. In terms of intestinal fortitude, they're a bunch of gutless bastards. And in terms of patriotism, they're a bunch of traitors, as far as I'm concerned. The words of contempt for these people, I can't even begin to put forth, is that, you know, like, it just angers me so much when you see this and when it's just so transparently obvious that this happened and these guys got away with it, you know?
Yeah.
That's what really irks me, is that these guys, you know, and I mean, that's the other thing that comes out in this book, is that the CIA basically were beyond, they just felt that, you know, the government was just sort of another minor nuisance that they had to deal with, that they had to get around. They were making foreign policy, not the president, they were.
Yeah, no, I don't see the American government doesn't serve the American people. It's been hijacked by the Israeli lobby and other corporate interests. I mean, they don't serve Americans anymore. I mean, there's just such terrible things happening through America, and the government does nothing. They just, they just hand Bush everything he wants. All his terrorist legislation and everything is terrible.
Speaking of which, in the last couple of weeks, I had noticed a couple of things. Number one, all the major oil corporations, BP, I think Chevron, there's four of them, and now there's been a fifth one. The ones that were kicked out of Iraq when Saddam Hussein nationalized the oil industry are going back into Iraq to start pumping oil. That's the first one. Unocal, which wants to build the pipeline to Central Asia through Afghanistan, is now beginning to proceed with the building of the pipeline. And some guy who, government official, who blew the whistle on, I don't know if it's Brown Root Kellogg or one of these major criminal outfits that is making billions of dollars in stealing from the American taxpayers in Iraq.
Yeah.
This guy blew the whistle on them and called up their irregularities, and he got fired. There you go. It's the beat goes on. The extent of these criminal activities is just incredible.
Disheartening. It's so sad.
Meanwhile, people are starving and are homeless. In a country where these guys, regularly start these things, these wars, make their American sons and daughters go over and lose their lives, and may get rich doing it.
And then there's like 4,000 murdered, dead soldiers, but then you got seven times that who have major lost legs, arms, serious physical. And then you got hundreds of thousands who are going to come back with post-traumatic stress disorder.
Not to mention uranium poisoning and...
It's just unbelievable. Yeah, and then all their inoculations. And then they pretend that it's somehow patriotic. If you care for the soldiers, you back the government. Like, it's so insane. If you care for the soldiers, you'd reveal the truth about these, and you'd try these treasonous people.
Yeah. The other side of it too is that it just, and this again is, it kind of fits in with the whole thesis of what was happening 45 years ago and what's happening now. But reading about Vietnam, I read a couple of years ago. I read Secrets, which is Daniel Ellsberg's memoir. You know, Ellsberg was the guy that was a defense policy analyst, and he had actually been in Vietnam. He was a Marine captain in Vietnam in the early 60s when there were just a few advisors there. And his book is really interesting, because it gave an overview of what he went through and his change of mind about, he started out believing that the United States should be in Vietnam and then realized that, this is a really tragic mistake, and then it was like a criminal enterprise. And what really struck me in reading his book, the thing that really surprised me, was the extent to which everything that passed through the Department of Defense was indicating that this war could not be won, no matter what the rhetoric was, no matter what the body count lies were, no matter, if we didn't have our hands tied, we could do this. No, it was very clear, and fairly early on, by 64, 65, they knew they couldn't win, and yet the war continued. And this is like the very top guys in the American military. Basically, they allowed it to continue because that's what these guys do.
To them, they win no matter who wins because they make the money selling the weapons.
Yeah, it's the military industrial complex.
Exactly.
It's like these guys are so invested in this that it doesn't, it's hard to believe that, that anybody could be that cynical and anybody could be that greedy to allow, 55,000 Americans die in Vietnam.
Yeah.
A million, 2 million Vietnamese die, untold suffering, and for what? So these guys can make more money.
I know.
How friggin' twisted.
The whole time they completely deceive the American public. So the American public think that they're doing something noble.
Yeah.
They're standing up for peace. Oh, yeah. Now they're spreading democracy in Iran.
Fighting,
you know, murder 1.2 million people while you're spreading. But they don't say we're going over there to murder people and take the oil. They say we're going to spread democracy. And everyone waves their little flags, you know.
Pathetic. Even for somebody as cynical as me, I have to say I was quite shocked when I read that book. That wow. I mean, these guys knew this was unwinnable, and still, you know, they just kept putting people in the meat grinder and saying, you know, yeah, get over there and die, you know?
Yeah, it's just unbelievable.
You know?
It's like, how could people, like, how could they have such level of greed and perversion and such to do this? Like, you know, intentionally mass murder people to be making money and have power. It's just unbelievable. It's like the lowest, the scum rises to the top. I guess that's kind of what happened. You have a criminal elite who's taken over the United States, you know? And not only the United States, I mean, they're in Canada too, England. You know, that's what's happened. It's kind of such a systemic problem. It's unbelievable.
If you think the guys running the United States are bad, the boys running Russia under Putin, you want to talk about major criminals. I mean, these guys have raised to an entirely different level of art. I mean,
China.
Oh, and China, well, yeah.
Yeah, China too. I mean, they harvest organs from the practitioners of that spiritual practice, Falun Gong. It's not just the United States, and it's not the United States.
That's not
what it is. It's not the American people.
Yeah.
It's these criminal elements who have taken over the U.S. government, and they control the media. So they've been able to systematically brainwash population.
Yeah, as I say, Bugliosi talks about these kooks, which apparently is 75% of the American public, because that's what believes that Kennedy was killed by a...
Oh, 75% of the public, yeah.
Yeah, and apparently after Oliver Stone's movie, something like January and February of 1993, 52% of the American public poll thought the CIA had been involved in his murder. So, kooks. But the other side of it all is, like, you know, all this started because of people like Mark Lane, who was an attorney and who had been hired by Oswald's mother to represent him.
Yeah.
She didn't believe he did it, and to represent him before the Warren Commission, and he couldn't get standing. But then he became involved in the case, and they appointed the head of the American Bar Association to represent Oswald's interests, and there were 51 sessions of the Warren Commission. And this guy attended two, and he never said one word in Oswald's favor. But other than that, but it was people like Mark Lane who produced this book, and then a lot of people like housewives professional people and students who did the groundwork. There's actually a book which I haven't read yet about the early assassination researchers. Well, I know Mae Brussel and I know Sylvia Mahar are two women who worked very extensively. I think we're both housewives who worked very extensively and wrote really interesting books. Harold Weisberg, another independent researcher. I mean, a guy named Jones, another one who actually Robert Kennedy consulted with. These people all, on their own initiative, started saying, you know, this thing stinks to high heaven, and they did the work, and they're the heroes, you know. And all of
you got a lot of American heroes. Like,
you got them
out there now, these people who are standing up, and like the architects and engineers for 9/11 Truth, David
situation.
Ray Griffin, and,
yeah.
you know, these people in the Truth radio networks, and I mean, there's, you know, the real Americans are standing forward, like they're waking up. We realize that, you know, we're in a pretty serious situation. I was just going to say, the other interesting thing is that this year, even E. Howard Hunt released that deathbed confession where he confessed that he was there and involved in it.
Yeah, he talked.
So it's like, okay, so now this guy in the CIA confesses that the CIA was involved with it, but, nothing's going to happen, you know.
Yeah, there's another guy who was an assassin for the CIA named David Morales, who has passed away, but who, from all accounts, seems to have been involved in the actual doing of it. The other thing, too, is interesting, was Dave Phillips, David Atlee Phillips, I think, Dave Phillips is his name. He also went by, he had an alias, which I'll think of in a second. But anyway, he was a CIA station chief in Mexico City and also director of operations in the Western world. One of his tasks was, when Mark Lane brought his book out, his book was published in 1966, and as I say, it was introduced by Hugh Trevor Roper, who was one of the greatest living historians, a British historian at that time, and endorsed by Bertrand Russell and you know, several prominent intellectuals, non-American. And one of Dave Phillips's jobs was to spread disinformation about Mark Lane and saying he was making all this money from it and he was motivated by
profit. Oh, yeah, they always have their smear campaign.
And they engaged in an extensive smear program. And then, you know, like the same thing happened with Garrison. NBC did a number on him. These guys keep producing these ridiculous books, you know, ridiculous documentaries from the networks. The networks are, you know, the American networks are all an embarrassment. I mean, they're an embarrassment to journalism, you know.
They're actually part of a criminal mafia, really.
Incredible. Right. But, you know, speaking of people and speaking of how, you know, people, I mean, the bigger picture is that everybody's asleep, you know. Are you going to talk about? Oh, we're actually, it's almost quarter to.
Yeah, we're not going to have time.
We're running out of time here. But I was just going to say that, you know, like, I mean, remember back we were talking about personality in essence before and the Gurdjieff work, and we're talking about how, you know, personality is what we acquire through life and through our imitation and our conditioning and our socialization and our education. In essence, Gurdjieff says it's what we are. In and of ourselves, and then sort of until about the age of six, it develops. But then personality overgrows it like a crust, and some people's essence is stunted. And even the most accomplished people who are very well versed in a variety of subjects and fashion successful careers, can often have the essence of a child. And I was thinking of the when I was doing my lecture before on the BBS when you were away. One of the things I was trying to get to and to talk about that was that the story that Uspensky tells in Search of the Miraculous is to how all of Gurdjieff's pupils, when they would gather in his apartment in Moscow, they used to not speak. They called it keeping silence so that they'd avoid unnecessary talking.
Mm-hmm.
Because this is a... Gurdjieff said that unnecessary talking, it's funny being on the radio doing 2 hours, unnecessary talking is one of personality's most automatic manifestations, eh?
Yeah.
So Uspensky invites a friend of his who is interested in meeting Gurdjieff and hearing about his ideas, and he describes what happens. He says that his friend VAA produced the impression of, quote, being sufficiently alive, unquote, to be considered. So his friend comes to have lunch with Gurdjieff. And Gurdjieff greets him as the perfect toast and has Uspensky's friend sit right beside him. And Uspensky says he realized belatedly that Gurdjieff was testing his friend. And he says, the fact was that everyone kept silence. A held out for 5 minutes, then he began to talk. He spoke of the war, of all our allies and enemies together and separately. He communicated the opinions of the public men of Moscow and St. Petersburg upon all possible subjects. Then he talked about the desiccation of vegetables for the army, particularly the desiccation of onions. Then about artificial manure, agricultural chemistry, and chemistry in general, about spiritism, the materialization of hands, and about what else I do not remember now. And then Uspensky goes on, he says, his friend got so carried away with his own talk and his own need to express his attitudes and opinions and beliefs that he was completely unaware that nobody else had said a word since he began talking. And as he says, his friend was revealed to be a fool, and that Gurdjieff was using him to prove a point to his pupil. So after the guy leaves, he thanks Gurdjieff at the end of the dinner for a quote-unquote very interesting conversation and departs, and Gurdjieff laughs slyly and said, "There, you see, he is called a clever man, but he would not have noticed it even if I had taken his trousers off him. Only let him talk. He wants nothing else, and everybody is like that. This one was much better than many others. He told no lies, and he really knew what he talked about, in his own way, of course. But think, what use is he? He is no longer young, and perhaps this was the one time in his life when there was an opportunity of hearing the truth, and he talked himself all the time."
Wow.
And, you know, that's, in a sense, that's the beginning. And then there's false personality on top of personality, where people get all these, you know, these twisted and deceived ideas. Like reading about these guys in that Kennedy book in the military and the CIA, you realize, boy, you got to be pretty deformed and twisted and have a pretty twisted understanding of yourself and life and life's possibilities to think that, you know what the best solution to this problem is? We ought to just drop a nuclear bomb on these creeps, you know, and that'll be the end of our problems. I mean, it really just goes to show you how, you know, out of touch with reality people, even accomplished people, even people who hold positions of responsibility and power and trust, are really quite diseased, you know, and
yeah.
quite psychopathic. As they say, it's, you know, well, what's Robert, is it Eisen's term about the psychopathocracy, you know?
Yeah, psychopathocracy. Yeah, yeah, it's not a democracy, it's a
yeah.
psychopathocracy.
Or as I call it, a demonocracy.
Because a demonocracy,
it seems like
yeah.
it's ruled by demons, you know? Like, it's not the expression of the will of the people, it's the expression of the will of the demons, you know? It,
yeah.
It just shows how, just think like how twisted people have to be, like, and deformed in terms of their spirit and stunted in terms of their growth to
yeah.
reach these.
And how it amazes me that all these people in the military, like the officers, I mean, they all swear oaths to their country and
yeah.
to defend their country against enemies, foreign and domestic. Like, don't people realize? I mean, I'm sure it's in the CIA and FBI, like,
yeah,
my goodness! Don't
yeah.
aren't there enough of these people in who
yeah.
really believe that and really take their oath to heart? I mean,
apparently not.
Well, no, apparently not. I mean, that's true.
That's,
apparently not. You know,
that's what's as I say. I wasn't being facetious when I said, you know, it was kind of shocking reading this stuff about how insubordinate the military was towards the president, and say, hey, this
yeah.
guy was elected president. You know,
yeah,
I was like,
yeah.
You really. You know, in the military, if somebody acted that way, they'd be taken out and shot. Like, I mean, I didn't mean that facetiously. I meant it
yeah.
literally. You know, I was like, you just can't disobey a direct order because you think you know better. You know, or you can't, like, the CIA is like, oh, well, you know, this guy's elected, but he's a crummy president, so we're going to have to get him out of the way.
Yeah.
You know, like.
No, I think that's what people have begun to realize now, that the government is not really the government. There's something. There is a shadow government. There has been for a long time.
Yeah.
And you know, I mean, even someone like Bush. I mean, in a way, he's just a puppet, and he's been brought up, and he serves a certain role. But he's not the grand schemer.
No, and that's the really disturbing aspect of it all. Is that that the more you look into these things, the more you realize, boy. There's a lot of really horrific manipulation going on.
As
you say, the other side of it all is just think if these people were in jail where they belonged and people really, the institutions that were supposed to serve people really did serve them.
I know.
How much
wouldn't
better
that
life,
be unbelievable,
how
eh?
A better life could be for everybody, you know?
Yeah. You know, if you took away the assets from those who have made their monies through criminal activities, and you really brought all these crimes, past crimes up, you'd probably retrieve enough money back to the United States of America that would probably pay off their national debt, because their national debt is probably to these people who have schemed all these things.
Yeah.
You know, it would completely change the country.
Yeah.
You know, the Federal Reserve has to be, you know, you have to take away the Federal Reserve for sure. That's, like, so profoundly important to this whole scheme. Even it was brought in a criminal way, really, if you go back into the history of how it was pushed through.
The whole thrust of everything since the end of the Second World War is, like, what Gore Vidal says is that the United States is the national security state, you know, and that's, you know, the National Security Act of 1947 created the CIA, which is the successor to the OSS, and really, you know, Eisenhower, a mere, you know, 12, 13 years later, was warning people about the military-industrial congressional complex, you know.
Yeah.
And really, that's what's happened is that in the United States is that it's the power of these huge multinational corporations to manipulate things and
yeah.
to do anything to, you know, ensure that they're always making more money and
always doing whatever will
ensure that they make more money, and that they're really like a bunch of sociopaths, you know.
Yeah, they are.
There's like
they literally are.
Documentary by the Canadian guys, you know, on the corporations, where he compares them to psychopaths. I mean, basically.
Oh yeah, I've seen that. Yeah, the corporation.
That's really what they are. Is that they're completely out of control and they're completely dangerous. And you know, it's funny, anyway, the fascination in the United States and in the West in movies with serial killers, and really the real serial killers are the ones that are running the governments and
I know
and the corporations, you know. No, those guys are serial killers, you know. It's like
it's funny to watch.
They don't eat your liver with a nice Chianti like Hannibal Lecter, you know. They send your sons and daughters to die in foreign lands for, you know, so that they can get richer.
Yeah, it's disgraceful.
It really,
you know, and the role, and it's not just America, you know, it's probably every country of the world. I mean, I really don't know, but I'm sure it is. I mean, these people are, I mean, their plan is one world government. I mean, that's where they're moving.
Well, I don't even know, you know, it's just like, to me, it's like, you know, Uspensky said it 125 years ago, you know, it's like the criminal elements who run things. I mean, you know, it really hasn't changed in any way. Or Gibbon in, the, you know, the 18th century and the rise and the fall of the Roman Empire, you know, wrote that history is the history of crime, you know, and that's basically it. But,
yeah, it's very sad, the great country in the United States and... you know, it's a great drama. I think of it sometimes as God's story.
Yeah.
I kind of woke up to this kind of nightmare that's happening in the world, and it's like we're at like possible Armageddon type period in human history. You know, and this great tale of psychopaths and perverts, you know, is terrible.
Well, maybe a big 0 point hole.
Yeah, little black hole.
Lock them all in, you know. We should the next time talk about zero. Oh, actually, I just meant to mention to you too, Chris, that I don't know. Ironically, I'm going to be in Ottawa 2 weeks from today, but I don't know if I can do the show because I'm going for my brother's 40th wedding anniversary party, and it's at 6 o'clock downtown. But I might be able to join you for the first hour of the show. But
and I do have a guest that day.
Oh, okay, so that might work out well then.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, hopefully you'll be able to listen in somewhere, and maybe you can call in for part of it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Who is the guest going to be?
He's the head of the Ottawa 9/11 Truth Group.
Oh, wow.
And they go out on the streets of Ottawa the 11th of every month, and they give out all their DVDs, Loose Change and Endgame and all these DVDs. And so I'm going to attend their next, on the 11th, if you want to join us up at Parliament Hill in Ottawa on the 11th, at about 6 o'clock, they're meeting at the Parliament Hill in Ottawa. And then the fellow from that group is going to be on the radio show the next day.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Make sure you get your profile, that, and, you know, best side for your picture taken by the RCMP.
Yeah, they'll be everywhere. You know, that's last time I went to the Montebello thing, and I was going along to all the police. 9/11 is an inside job. Why are you guys protecting the criminals? Look at what's happening. Like trying to wake the police up. See, it's like we need the police to wake up. Okay, so we'll be back in 2 weeks' time. We will get back to the zero-point teaching, and thanks, Jim.
Yeah.
Thanks, BBS Radio.
Thanks, Doug and Don. Yep.
And keep up the good fight, people. The truth is coming out. The truth will set us free. We need to bring about a new age, not a new world order.
Yeehaw.
Amen.
Okay, see ya.
Where would $5,000 per week take you? Discover the exact details of a simple and proven system that quickly puts $5,000 to $10,000 in many students' pockets every week. What's most amazing is that there are almost no computer skills required, and you can start pulling in cash automatically within just a few hours. We are absolutely convinced that our proven system will create massive wealth for virtually anyone, and we'll prove it. Go to bbscashflow.com now and get all the details. That's bbscashflow.com.